Everybody, and welcome to Space Force. I am Jason Tondreau.
And I'm Taya Mori.
And we are back. Discovery was on about a month break while we finished up the back half of Star Trek Prodigy, which, Taya, you watched, I think.
Yeah, I saw every episode. I actually really enjoyed it. It is a really it's a pleasant sequel to Star Trek Voyager that I didn't know I wanted or needed. Yeah. But I kind of now, you know, I very much appreciate it.
I never really got into Voyager. I watched like the first couple of episodes. It kind of bored me. And then I would, every once in a while, I would see it online. See an episode. But I have been delighted by all of the Voyager fans rejoicing in Janeway's comeback, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. That's been fun. I watched the first few episodes of Prodigy. One person that I read on Twitter described it as a bunch of Star Wars characters who would feel they would rather live in Star Trek, and so they go about trying to make that happen. What do you think?
I saw that tweet. I think it's the most apt description of Star Trek Prodigy there is, because the show takes so much from the aesthetics and the pacing of, say, a Star Wars Rebels, or one of the more contemporary cartoon shows that franchise is producing, except it's set in the Star Trek and its characters learning about Star Trek from the framework of, like, you can understand your dad's the evil person because Star Wars has trained you that your dad is invariably evil.
Yeah.
So you already have that hook. You can understand being alone and not knowing your place. So you have that help with Dodge. And then you start, you know, getting introduced to, this is how a holodeck works.
Yeah.
This is how faster than light travel works. This is how the computer works. Like, and you start getting acclimated, like, while the characters are getting acclimated to what life is like in a Star Trek, it all comes back down to teamwork, walking together. Even when you're alone, you're still walking as a unit to accomplish something. And that is something invariably that is entirely Star Trek, because Star Wars is really about, like, the lone, you know, Jedi, or the lone freight captain. You know, it's very much a bunch of loners who kind of work together, but they don't really.
So what you're saying is that if we're going to make it through this, we're going to do it together.
Which is what we're going to do in this episode, because it's just the two of us.
Well, once again, for those who are longtime Space Force fans, Aide Smith, our third member, the triumvirate in this. I'm not sure who he would. Maybe he's Pompey. But the third member of our triumvirate has not been able to watch the show because Netflix, Paramount didn't have a channel in the UK for him to watch it on easily. I'm hoping that will still be able to change. That we'll be able to get him on soon enough so we can have Aide back when we do Picard season two. Speaking of Picard, there is not a Star Trek show out there that doesn't benefit from the casino episode, and so that's what we got. That's what we got this time. And like the casino episode from Picard's first season, it becomes an opportunity for everybody to act out a little bit and get kind of crazy and do shit that they would never otherwise do. And whether it's Picard's funny accent or Owo turning into Oh Wow the Brawler,
I don't think it quite reaches the level of Patrick Stewart doing his French accent. It looks at that summit. It goes up the mountain. It looks at the summit and goes, no, we're just going to take the side path. We don't need to go there.
So before we get into the show, though, there's one other thing I kind of wanted to touch on, and that's that perhaps to draw some attention to the show coming back after its month hiatus, we had a run of like six out magazine covers starring various members of this crew. And it really spotlighted the LGBTQ nature of this particular incarnation of Star Trek. And I maintain my stance on that Saru is the straight white guy of this show. And it's been wonderful, because let's see, we had I can't name all the performers who were involved, but maybe you can.
Well, let's see. Now you put me on the spot. There was Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz, the space daddies on the show.
Yeah.
Blue Del Rio and I want to say so there was the space daddies, and then there was those space children, and yeah. Blue plays Adira, and I'm drawing a blank on Gray's real name.
Yeah.
And then Mary Weissman was on one of the couples because she is bisexual. And Emily Kupoltz, who plays Detmold, came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the process of doing the show. And I think that's kind of amazing.
It was really interesting. I loved reading her observations. And there was even like, hey, and maybe this will work into the character in the show, which a lot of us have been standing Detmer and Owo anyway. So
those are some meaningful looks. In fact, the only thing that this episode really misses is the fact that like Owo doesn't show up on the ship a little bruised up, and then those Detmold to Nonsol back. Like that's like the fan fiction, you know, the main character gets haunt and the side love interest helps him, you know, get through the pain.
There is a lot of fan fiction spinning up for the post all-in scenes. When Owo returns to the ship and Detmer is there to lend her a little bit of tender loving care. Yeah, for sure.
She has that gash. That gash doesn't go away. It's pretty
we have to get like the if it was Daredevil, it would be sewing. We give it like the needle scene where we like sew your back up. But this being Star Trek, we'll probably just apply a Plastiflesh or something. All right. But anyway, everybody's very glamorous on their covers. It was delightful to see. And I thought it was a fun celebration of this show. But let's get on with the episode. So All In, we're picking back up after we found out where the mysterious Tensi aliens live. They live in another galaxy. They live beyond the galaxy. We know where they are, sort of, but we don't really. And the big conflict that split Michael from Book at the end of last episode was that Book and Tarka, the scientist, the rogue scientist, have determined to make a weapon, which they are going to use to destroy the anomaly at some great risk. Meanwhile, the Federation and its allies want to try to establish first contact with this species instead, and not to do anything that might be determined or perceived as hostile, since reasoning that if alien species 10C can create an object like the anomaly, then their technology is vastly superior to that of the Federation and other species in the Alpha Quadrant. And so we want to not piss them off if we don't have to. They might not know that what they're doing is harmful. Well, the subplot to this episode is learning the answer to that question. We actually find out what the DMA is at the end of this episode. It is a resource collector. It travels through space and collects this rare material, which I had never heard of before. Maybe it's a part of the setting. I don't know, Taya. You'll come to our rescue on this. But they collect this rare material that's floating in tiny, almost infinitesimally small quantities in empty space. And they need a huge amount of it in order to sustain their society, which apparently is completely surrounded by some sort of bizarre energy bubble, like about the size of a Dyson sphere. So for those, Dyson spheres have appeared in Star Trek before, but a Dyson sphere is the idea of like a sphere that is a megastructure in space, which encloses a sun and some of its planets. This is not a physical sphere. It's not a metallic object that you can fly up to and knock on. It appears to be some kind of energy bubble within which species 10C conceals itself. Interestingly, still making it so that we don't know what they look like or don't know anything about their society. They're still a black box. But we know where the black box is. And we know that this thing that they've created, the anomaly, is not a weapon. It's a mine. It's a mineral. It's a drill, essentially, that unintentionally destroys whatever it comes across. But that's in theory what this episode is about, or the payoff at the end. But it's really about when Book and Burnham both end up on this casino outside of Federation space, where they have to they have to compete for the rare material, which Book and Tarka need to create the weapon. And if they can, if Book and Tarka get the stuff, they will use it to make this weapon that will destroy the DMA. So Burnham tries to stop them from getting it by acquiring the material first. And this, because we're at a casino, all kinds of wacky shenanigans take place. Most spectacularly, Owo gets in a cage fight brawl with a anonymous dude, and they fight three rounds, and they finally win tons of credits, but tons of gold plus platinum. But there's also some gambling, some card gaming with between Book and Burnham as well. Lots of opportunities for, hey, remember that thing that we did in the place that time, going on in this episode.
I think they only used it once. It was only used once. Like, if I was looking for it, because that was something you brought up in the previous episodes when Burnham and Book have been working together. And it was only brought up like right before the poker game starts.
Yeah, because that's how they figure out that they're going to team up against the other players, right? The camera very carefully shows us each of them doing things, touching their code, their secret gambling code. It's only once, but it's key, right? Mm-hmm. It's key to the whole episode. It turns it into a sting.
Yeah, I think it was much better used in this episode than, say, in the previous episodes, like of last season, where it was like every other time it was, oh, remember that thing on this place? And yeah, we got it as a shorthand, but I like the fact that because they are at odds, like she only goes to that well once.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't go anywhere near that well.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Book is, So ultimately the card game comes down to basically one bet. I found this very interesting because Book and Burnham are on the opposite sides of this hand of cards. And Book feels like he has to do what he has to do. And Burnham feels like she has to do what she has to do. And she tries to get him to just fold and just let her have it. But what he does is he basically doesn't do any tactics or strategy at all. In other words, he doesn't ask for new cards. He doesn't try to bluff anybody. He doesn't even look at his cards. He just pushes all of his money in and kind of leaves his fate to chance. Like, okay, either I'm going to win or I'm going to lose. And this is kind of, in my opinion, it was Book's way of choosing not to choose. Now, that's bullshit, because by not surrendering, he was choosing. But he chose to give up his decision-making authority and simply trust the cards. Well, if I'm supposed to yield to Michael here, then I'll have lousy cards. But if I'm supposed to keep this latinum and go build this weapon, then I will have good cards. And it's interesting to see Book surrendering his self-determination the way that he has to Tarka and the way that he has in this. He's I don't like him as much when he's letting other people lead him around, you know. Anyway,
I did not pick up on that because I'm not a poker player.
Sure.
I was actually kind of okay, so I kind of didn't like this episode.
Okay.
This felt like a Star Trek episode by way of a Buffy episode.
Now tell me what you mean by that.
Well, we'll introduce to a very flamboyant alien that could easily be a transplant from a Joss Whedon Buffy Angel episode. Like, the makeup wise, he looked like he would fit very easily. Sort of outgoing, gregarious character. And putting people in through like zany situations. So by the time we got to Poco was the resolution, I was already kind of irritated.
Yeah.
And then it was like alien space Poco. So I'm like, I vaguely have an idea of what's going on.
I gotcha.
But it kind of felt like, You know how in Casino Royale, the Bond movie, they spend a lot of time building up the tension and the stakes of the poker game? This felt like we want to have that energy, but we're not going to make it exciting. It just felt like, oh, we're just going to have it. We're going to do it for laughs to get to the final confrontation, which is the bridge scene, which is what you're talking about. When they start talking about, you know, if you win this Isolinium, all the bridges are burnt. And he's like, even all relationship. And it's all left unsaid. Like, no one wants to commit because no one wants to end the relationship.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And you just kind of have to sort of intuit the conversation from that point on.
Yeah. It is interesting. Like, is this the end of their relationship? Is it over now?
I don't know where you go from this, honestly, like in terms of like a relationship. Like, he's building a super weapon.
I you're right. However, Burnham is so, Burnham would forgive him. Like, she would say, I could very much easily hear Michael saying, you know, like, you were upset over reasonably upset over the loss of your entire planet. You're under a lot of stress. Like, you made some big, you're doing some things that are wrong. But if she's able to stop him and no bad thing happens besides Owo gets punched in the face, then I could see her letting him go for it.
Well, there was a difference between forgiving someone and taking someone back into your bed.
Yeah, that's true.
That's sort of like the stakes. Like, the reason why I was kind of annoyed with the poker game being the resolution is the stakes are already the relationship. Yeah. And then to spice it up, we have to introduce two other characters who are generic gangster one and two. Like, they don't even get names. They get credits, I think. I read somewhere that they were credited in the script with names. They get no personality. It's not even like I go back to Casino Royale. When you go into that movie, there was a lot of people, but they either had a really distinct visual to them, like the really heavy set black man in purple, or Felix Leiter was there. Like, there was ways to introduce these side characters to make your game interesting without it just being like, oh, they want the same thing. They want to be, you know, they want to take over the Emerald Chain, which is cool. But there was no conflict between those two side characters, even though they're sitting next to each other and their stated goals, we want the same job.
You know, it reminded me less of the Casino Royale, which is all about a poker game, and more like the opening scenes in Ocean's 11.
Okay.
Where Rusty and Danny end up like fleecing all of these celebrities of all of their money over a poker table. And they're both kind of in on it. They're both in on the con. And I only say that because the poker thing, although it is the climax of the episode, is actually kind of a come down from all the physical action in the previous reel.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening in this episode.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This is an episode that has a B plot of one scene, and everything else is devoted to plot A.
So let's talk about that B plot, because you're talking about the Culber scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whenever those are previously, whenever those are previously on Star Trek Discovery,
yes,
what they're doing is they're not just reminding the audience, they're telling the audience how to watch the episode.
Yes.
So yes, it's reminding you of the things that you saw last week or last month or, you know, 5 minutes before you saw the streaming this episode because you binge watched it. But it's also telling you, like, these are the plot points that really matter that we're going to be addressing through this episode.
That's right.
One of those plot points was Kovacs's conversation with Culber in terms of saying, hey, you need to start doing something else because you can't take this all on your shoulders.
Yeah.
You're going to make a mistake.
And that's so that when that specific conversation gets referenced in the scene, mm-hmm. we've seen it in the previously on Star Trek Discovery.
So we've always been caught up to it. We've been reminded about the importance of that scene, and the dialogue lifted from that scene is incorporated in the previously on.
That's right. Yeah.
But that's entirely like when they cut those things, they're cutting it with an eye towards what matters in this episode.
For sure. So, I totally agree.
Yeah. So it gives you the shorthand. And the scene is basically Cobol is cleaning up the room and he's snapping at a robot, a cleaning droid, which is just, I want one of those. especially with three dogs, it would make life so much easier to have a droid.
For sure.
But then, my brain starts going like, okay, there's a droid. Is the droid connected to Zora? Is this an automated program? Is this a Star Wars situation where we have droid with Ryan? Like, see, so the cleaning droid, like, just sent me down a rabbit hole of, like, ramifications that I do not think was considered when they were like, we need to show Cobol acting out of character, but we don't want him taking it out on another person. Let's put this sort of baseless, cute robot here.
Yeah. There's this similar moment in Babylon 5. Do you remember the Talia Winters' famous last episode?
Mm-hmm.
And Ivanova is like storming around the kitchen, slamming doors. And Talia says something like, well, that's one kitchen door that'll never insult anyone again, right? And it's similar, but there's no robot, right? So here is, okay, let's insert the robot so that we can have kind of, and it's actually kind of played for laughs. The robot comes out after Culber has left and starts cleaning the room. And we're like, okay, the revenge of the droid.
It's a cute scene. Don't get me wrong. It's a cute scene. I like the scene overall. I like the fact that they reminded us, okay, this is what Gray is. And I looked it up. It's Ian Alexander.
I got thrown
off because I was like, I knew Ian was right, but I didn't know if it was soul name or false name.
Yeah.
So we got the reference that he is on Trill, building a life for himself.
Yeah.
So we got some exposition taken care of. And then we got this really sweet scene where they talk about uncertainty.
Yeah.
And as someone who's been going this last week with a lot of uncertainty, it was really nice just to have two people like not just talk about anxiety, but like specific anxiety towards being in a place where you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then like the solution is let's go to the holodeck and take a walk, which is what the fucking holodeck was always meant to be.
right.
When it's introduced in Next Generation, it was explained like this was a way for people to like mentally stimulate that wasn't necessarily like, oh no, we gotta fight Moriarty.
Yeah.
No, we gotta get new costumes. Like the whole point of it was to be the release valve.
Yeah.
And so the fact, and I was really disappointed that we didn't get to see this beautiful, like whatever it was that he was talking about with these flowers, because I would have just loved to have seen the space dads walking around for like 30 seconds.
Me too.
Space flowers. Like that would have been nice.
My favorite part of that exchange is when Culber's like, I am responsible for the mental well-being of every single person on this ship. And he goes, you realize that's completely unreasonable, don't you? and I just laughed because
and he sits down. Cobol sits down at that moment. Like that's when the body language changes because he says the unreasonable thing that's weighing on his mind. And we've all been there. We've all like taken on responsibilities that are not ours to take, really. That's and right. We all needed that other person to be like, you wouldn't expect anyone else to say that. Like, you wouldn't expect your friend to say that. Like, I would never expect you to say what he said. Like, it's unreasonable, and you would not put that on anyone else. So why are you putting it on yourself?
That's right. That's right.
It's a lovely scene. I wish there was more of it in this episode.
Yeah.
It's the one time when I was like, Discovery, you actually laser focus on your plot, and I commend you for that. And that's what I've been wanting you to do this entire time.
Okay.
But I think you focused on the wrong plot. Well, at least I cared about.
I did like it also because it's really highlighting one of the metaphors of this episode, which is Culber as a kind of COVID doctor. You know, like we've heard about, we've seen the nurses and the doctors in the hospitals talking about how much strain and how much stress they've been under over these last couple of years. And, you know, our heart breaks to read these personal stories about these folks just doing the best they can under just completely awful and unreasonably awful, like situations that are not, they should not be this bad, but they are. And that wear, the long, slow grinding wear of that is this B plot with Culber. And I like to see it. I like the episode overall better than you. I saw lots of interesting character moments. I liked Owo getting some spotlight time, right? At first when she was in the shuttle and she was like asking Burnham, like, okay, like, why am I here? And Burnham's like, well, you know, you wanted to help. And I know that people want to help. And so you're coming along. And I'm like, oh, okay. So she's just going to be like the sidekick who, like, you know, asks funny questions once in a while, or guard this person or whatever. You know, she's Ensign Leibowitz for the episode. But instead, she gets this great three round fight with, you know, anonymous big dude. And that reminded me of Tasha Yar back in the old early seasons of Next Generation. It was in one of the very early episodes.
It's in episode 2. It's Code of Honor, and it's awful, and it's racist, and it is permanently emblazoned on my brain.
Well, you know it much better than I. I have not seen it since I watched it the very first time, what, 20 years ago now? More than that?
Oh, more than that. Let's not get into how old.
Yeah, let's not do that. Because 20 years ago was Enterprise.
Yep.
Yeah, so it must have been more like 30. Anyway. As I thought about it, you know, your observation that the casino boss... Haz Mazzaro is his name. You're right. He does look like a Buffy villain, except with better makeup. Like the Buffy budget was always really tight, and Haz has a pretty cool look to him. Yeah.
And I don't mean that disparagingly. Like, I know I said that rather flippantly, that it's a Star Trek episode by way of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was an interesting thing. I just think we spent too much time in that space on the Karma Bulge. Like, they came up with a great name, Karma Bulge. Like, it's just a fantastic name. We have a screen chewing villain who's not a villain. So he's the best type of, like, well, I'm gonna fuck you because capitalism wants to fuck you, but I still like you because I still will probably need you in the future. Like, it felt very much like if you were gonna take all the Deep Space Nine scenes with Quark's ball and condense it into half an episode, it felt like you got everything you needed to. Like, there was even a changeling subplot.
So we have to talk about that because that's probably an important lore thing. I just wanted to make one other observation. As a GM, from a gamer's angle, this episode was fire. It gave me a cool location, right? Like the Casablanca in space location that I can take people to, with lots of cool role play and even combat. If you want to get into the MMA brawl, we can do that. But also lots of non-violent conflict going on, like the card game, which or trying to find. Okay, so Matt, you can see like the player characters in the room. And there's the quest giver, and he's like, okay, I've got two problems, right? Like, you know, and one of them is there's people cheating in my casino, and I want to know who it is. Well, if we find the cheaters, then you have to give us the Latinum. Like, well, okay, right? Okay. And so then they get to do some cool detective work and you know, figure out what's going on. At first, it was like some sort of insectoid alien that it looked like it had like Linus eyes, and they were sort of. And I thought, is this a Linus eye callback to like Linus's famous ability to see? And like,
we have to let that go, Jason. We just have to let that go. That was written so long ago that I don't think they even remember it. Like,
yeah, I'm sure
happy when Linus shows up in the background at this point.
Yeah. Well, anyway. But no, it turns out they're a changeling. And when they said changeling, they meant an actual changeling, like a from DS9. So is that important, do you think? Is this a big deal?
I think it was just to reemphasize the fact that, like, yes, we're in an alien location. Yes, we've been in this alien location for a long time. And it does have echoes of a Star Wars. It has echoes of other genre franchises, but then to be like, but also we've done our homework, and it's really just Quark's ball. Like, it really just is. Like, there's an alien who's in charge, and he's likable, and he's a scoundrel, and he's a scallywag, but he still cares about the thing you care about, because you care about Bonham and Book's love.
Yeah.
And yeah. He's still like, you know, I'm kind of pulling for that, you know, for you two kids.
Yeah.
Even though I'm putting you two together.
Yeah. But money is money, but I hope you work it out.
Yeah. Like so there's a lot of like really nice touches in there just to be like, okay, this is like, he turns into a fucking tribble. I mean,
the changeling, not.
Yeah,
not,
the changeling turns into a trip. Like, this is entirely just to say, okay, Star Trek has weird, outlandish elements to it. We're just going to visit one of those places.
Yeah, yeah. And not just any tribble, like a rocket powered rolling tribble. Like that, he was moving fast. I didn't think tribbles could do that.
Oh, yeah, this tribble was not going to eat anything. This tribble was getting the heck out of Dodge.
So. There's a couple of character moments in this episode, like Tarka and Owo actually have a conversation at one point. And she's like, why are you doing this? Is it revenge or what? And she figures out that he's doing it, at least as far as we can tell from the episode so far, out of some kind of loss, like he lost someone or he lost something. Now, he told us this story, and we're the jury is out on how much we believe this story, that he had like a scientist friend that he was working with, and they were both enslaved by, I think, the Emerald Chain, and they were gonna escape, and they were going to meet back up in another universe, in a parallel universe, like the Mirror Universe or the Kelvinverse or something like that. They were going to somehow meet up there. And he needs the energy from this machine that he's making in order to get there. Okay. Now, that sounds completely bogus because it's just so bizarre. But Owo, the way that scene is played out is that Owo gets on his nerves and seems to get something out of him that he didn't want her to know. And it doesn't necessarily confirm his story, but it does suggest that there is some sort of personal loss involved in Tarka's motivation. What did you get from any of this?
All right, so Discovery introduced a really interesting element in its first season.
Okay.
After the Mirror Universe stuff was done,
yeah,
had a meeting scene where Sarika Vulcan is like, we cannot divulge the information that there was a parallel universe because we have just gone through an onslaught of, well, losing the Klingon War, and people are going to want to find their relatives in parallel universes.
Oh, interesting. I forgot.
I think this is picking up more on that aspect, not necessarily tying it to the Mirror Universe, but the idea that you can cross a universe, you know, you can cross space and time,
yep,
to meet up with a dead loved one.
So maybe
whoever that may be,
yeah,
or what that means to Tarka, because it seems like Tarka's only really interested in his own ego.
Yeah.
Like, I really hope it's not some sort of like male himself version. Like, I hope it's more than a Loki variant at the end of this quest line.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're thinking that something like, you know, Tarka lost someone and he wants to go into another universe so he can find that universe's version of his mm-hmm. wife, significant other.
That's friend. My guess. That's just going off of the idea that I think his story is bullshit to Book, because yeah, he was a way too forthcoming and it had just enough crazy Star Trek-ness to it that was like, okay, I can see meeting up with another scientist in another universe, fine. And like, Book's like, my girlfriend comes from 1,000 years in the past, cool.
There's also an interesting scene with the Admiral.
The quest giver?
Exactly, Admiral Vance, one of the quest givers, right? And for the president refuses Burnham's request to go find Book herself. Vance backs her up, and then later comes to Burnham and says, "Hey, yeah, I had to back her up because we were in public, but if you could find some way to both get the information on species 10C that we need while also stopping Book, boy, that would be great. But as part of that, Vance has this monologue that he gives to Burnham, talking about how surprised and humiliated he is at Tarka's betrayal. That Tarka always had a big ego, but he never showed any signs of the betrayal that was coming. And then that combined with the conversation between Owo and Tarka, I'm starting to wonder, and this is an outside shot, but I'm starting to wonder if maybe Tarka is not Tarka. That at some point before he appeared on screen, the actual Tarka was replaced by someone or something. Or he's got a pod person inside of him, or something. Something is going on.
Don't give me hope that this is a womb and it's a conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's another thing that we probably need to let go. But oh, yeah. That and solving all of our problems with time travel, which we still go back to once in a while. But I don't know. It just seemed like everybody's talking about how, yes, okay, he's very egomaniacal, but it seems so unlike him to do this. Made me wonder, well, maybe there's an explanation for that. Maybe he's not who he appears to be. But I don't know.
So I'm going to go to professional wrestling.
Okay, good.
That's good. Sort of where my headspace is at this moment in time.
Okay.
There was a subplot when All Elite Wrestling launched. And the reason why my brain's going here is because that whole company is founded on a pay-per-view called All In. And this story is titled All In. And it's everyone going in. So my brain's already there. And then there was that fighting cage match thing. So my brain's being reinforced. There was a plot point in there where Cody Rhodes, the premier white meat babyface, befriended like a total egomaniacal asshole in MJF. And the whole plot point was, yes, I know he's an asshole, but he's my asshole. Like, he's not going to stab me in the back. So, of course, MJF, at the earliest opportunity, stabs in the back.
Right.
So I kind of think it was something like that. Well, we have to remember these two men met 10 years ago. Vance is removed from his family. He's living in a secluded space station. Yeah. Like, we're told that this, you know, Karma Bulge is on the outskirts of the Federation territory.
Sure.
In truth, the planet that they're located on used to be Federation space, because it's the same planet that all Discovery got swapped with the male universe Discovery. So it's a planet that keeps coming up. So it used to be in Federation space. Vance meets this man who comes up with all these wild ideas about how we can build the Federation back. So, of course, he's going to side with him because he's desperate. He wants to see his family. He doesn't want to be living in, he's having to compromise the ideals of the Federation so that the Emerald Chain can exist, so that they're not at war with each other, because it's a war he can't win.
Right, right.
So I kind of think he was just played.
Yeah.
Because he wanted this thing. Because during his speech, Vance says, you know, I don't want to have to say goodbye to my family again. I just got them back. And we saw that reunion episodes back.
We should have.
So it's this idea of, I think he was just manipulated, because it's what Tonka being, you know, Rycian, and we don't know if they have any sort of like superpower or empathic sense, but they're very accommodating to people's moods. And if you're very accommodating to someone's moods, you have to be able to read people. And I think Tolkien can just read people and will tell them whatever they want to hear to get to whatever his end goal is.
Yeah, that's been pretty well established in this season, is that Tarka's really good at manipulating people. When he gets Saru to scream at him, that's kind of like let me demonstrate my ability to manipulate people, right? To get them to do things that are out of character. So, that's a much simpler solution than mine.
And Tonka in that moment with Owo is so fixated on the game. Because his game, whatever his end game is so close at hand. And it's all riding on these two people playing a fucking card game. And you have to think about a guy who's that smart having to rely on chance and this one guy's wits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who may be compromised because he's in love with the person he's playing against.
Yeah.
Like, so that's the reason why Owo sneaks in. It's not like Owo does anything like to disarm him. Sure. It's just like he looks at Owo's like, oh, you're a lieutenant commander. I play the admiral like a fiddle. I don't need to focus on you. I gotta put all my attention on the game to follow what's going on to make sure I get what I need.
Yeah.
And that's when Owo sneaks in. Now, the other thing I wanna to mention is I didn't like the fight choreography.
Okay.
So, like I said, professional wrestling, something that I've spent way too much time on. But there was a way to tell a story with physical violence. Like, there was a way to tell a story, and I was really hoping that we would get that. I was hoping it'd be less MMA, which is just keep hitting the pulse until they stop moving.
Yeah.
More like two people, like two actors in this sense, walking together to tell a story about how Owo overcomes the giant.
Yeah.
And they kind of hint to that in the third round when she starts like focusing all on a leg, which is great. Like, that's like on Anderson, focus on the body part, keep hitting that body part till the guy starts moving. I love that. Like, it's heel tactics, but I still loved it.
Yeah. But
she goes through like two rounds of just getting her ass kicked with no like they could have shown us like him leaning on a leg a little bit more, or him like to set up the fact that, oh, I just have to beat up the leg. Cause then it just kind of looks like Owo gets her ass kicked for two rounds.
Yeah.
And isn't like only then goes, oh, I need to take him down to my size, which is what she does in the third round. But I don't feel like anything's set up. And you have three rounds, like you have the perfect three match structural to go into. Like, you could, I don't know. It's just, I was underwhelmed when I saw the fight ring there. I was like, oh, we're going to get something. Cause I don't watch the previews, but I saw the ring in the middle. I'm like, ooh, we're going to get like either Bonham or Owo, like someone's going to kick some ass. And I was really hoping for a little bit more, and the scene just kind of left me flat. And then I'm like, oh, okay. We're just going to keep getting hit. Like, we're going to do the Rocky thing. Misty, when we watched the Rocky movies years ago, would say like Rocky's fight strategy is this.
Yes.
And until he lands that one punch, and then the music swells, and then he wins, right? Like, that's essentially Rocky's things. He keeps getting hit until he gets enough of his battle meter gauge up, and then he has one punch. And that was kind of like Owo's strategy. And
well,
I'm a little disappointed by that.
Yeah, Rocky's best characteristic has always been his constitution.
Oh, yeah.
That he can take a punch. And that's his whole strategy is built around being able to take a punch. And he exhausts his opponent by, and you see, this is a boxing trope, right? Because once again, I have to go back to Daredevil because I had that show on the brain. Like, battling Jack Murdock is exactly the same, right? He's like, how am I going to beat my opponents? Well, I'm going to let them wear themselves out kicking my ass. And then I'm going to come back.
Because they break in between each fight, they break. And even if Owo was said, my strategy is to get him to tire himself out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to knock him out. Like, even if there was like some sort of like strategy from Owo telling Bonham, like, outside of, you know, let me stay in this thing.
Yeah.
Let me keep going. And I'm just like, that's not the rules of this fight. Like, you hit the mat once and it's done. And like, other people could be like, no, we're done with this. Like, I was surprised that everyone like kept going along with it.
Yeah. 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 It did feel a little weird from a plot angle, but I'm trying to remember. I had something, now it's gone. But So there's something that Hong Kong action movies have understood for a very long time, which has now become a bit of a truism. But I still think that Western filmmakers are having a hard time learning it. And that is that a fight scene can tell a story, just like you're talking about, right? And it has like dramatic acts inside of the 5-minute fight scene, and that's something that we didn't quite we didn't really see as much. I think I see what you're getting at. Like, the conclusion was okay, but it wasn't really set up right. Acts 1 and 2 were basically the same. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, like, the way that we tell a joke. And if you tell a joke that's got three parts to it, like, it's got, like, it's a repeating joke, and there's a long line in comedy that says, like, repeating something three times is funny, but if you do it twice or four times, neither of those are funny. There's something about doing it three times that makes it funny. And you get the feeling like they set up the scene the way that they did to have some kind of rule of three. Like, okay, we're gonna do it three times, but it's gonna be different on the third time. That's not how the story is told. There's gotta be a beginning and a middle and an end. And this three-part cage match didn't have a middle. It just had a long beginning. Mm-hmm. That stretched into two rounds, and then it had an end. And I think I see what you're getting at there.
Yeah, like if they had set it up well, instead of saying, like, you hit the mat once and the fight's over, if they had said, like, okay, this is going to be a three-round fight.
Yeah, do it like Karate Kid.
Yeah, this is going to be three rounds. You know, maybe the first round ends in a draw. The second round ends in the guy, the heavy guy winning.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, his leg is injured, and the third round is like, I'm going to take this guy apart and keep hitting his leg.
Yeah.
And then sweet, you get a finale, and you have a structure, you have a story, as opposed to a lot of quick cuts. Owo gets picked up and slammed on the ground a couple times.
Yeah.
Which was a little, you know, anticlimactic for me.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I now want to redo this as a sweep the leg shot.
Right. Like this one power move that, you know, you don't even have to set up the power move. Like, it could just be like something Owo has, like, on a character sheet. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I was really sort of underwhelmed by the fight sequence. And then when we got to Poco, and I'm like, okay, there was one thing I want to point out about the Poco.
Good.
They show a Queen Kong, and it's the queen with like a snail head.
Yes.
And that is a callback to the Star Trek Beyond alien makeup, which had that woman that Chekhov was hitting on at the very end of that film.
In the end.
You have the snail head. Yeah, and whenever you look up like Star Trek Beyond makeup, it's the one thing that shows up, because I think they may have won, they were at least nominated for an Oscar for makeup in Star Trek Beyond.
Okay, interesting.
And that's sort of the one like go-to alien that they always post out. So seeing a Kelvin alien in the Prime universe for the first time, I was like, okay, that's... I'm super glad that your corporation has realigned itself so that we can bring in cool elements from Prime, from Kelvin into Prime.
Kelvin versus Deep Cut. Speaking of uniting the franchise, Kate Mulgrew has come to Star Trek Online at last, and is actually voicing two different characters. She's voicing Janeway and Mirror Universe Evil Janeway, who are both showing up at the same time. So Janeway is all over. She is everywhere now.
I had someone who was so excited about this news that they texted me, like DM'd me in Twitter to be like, hey, check this out. And I'm not even a Star Trek Online player.
Yeah.
I tried it a couple times. When they came out with the TOS stuff, I was pretty, you know, I spent several months playing it at that point. But for whatever reason, like, Star Trek Online has never quite got its hooks in me. I don't know why. Like, there's no reason it shouldn't.
Yeah.
But you know, once you visit DS9 and you go to the Starfleet Academy grounds and you're flying around in your Enterprise, hearing the sounds, like, maybe the thing that so Star Trek for me is like limitless potential, limitless possibilities. It's this grand canvas, and we can tell whatever story we want. But once you gamify that, once you put it into binary, like, video game language, where you have to set up like X number of outcomes for a solution, I get less interested, because now I can't be like, oh, my human adventure is I'm not going to touch my phasal, but the adventure is shoot 15 tribbles to collect your prize and turn it into like Gullivac or some nonsense like that. And I'm like, I don't even know if that's an actual mission. I'm just making up one. So I apologize to everyone who loves Star Trek Online.
No,
it's a game for me.
Well, this is the classic difference between an online game and a traditional tabletop role-playing game, right? Like, if you're sitting on a table with your friends, you can tell the GM, like, no, like, my character doesn't take a phaser. I'm gonna do this mission without a weapon. And you can sandbox everything, right? And you have that ability to kind of make up the story as you go along, which Star Trek really can reward that sandbox kind of gaming structure where the players can do anything. It's an interesting combination. It's an interesting setting because on the one hand, it has this limitless galaxy where there's so many plots and stories going on and the characters can have great authority over what they do. But at the same time, they're usually members of Starfleet. So there's a superior over them that can give them an instruction. So that's very cool from a GM's point of view. You can say, okay, we received a distress signal from base station Kappa 12. Please go check it out. And then everything from that point, like the GM has been given, you're given the mission. So I don't have to worry about, well, how do I get the players to go on this mission? Because their bosses simply tell them, go on this mission. But then they have complete freedom to solve that and explore that Kappa 12 base station however they want. And they can, it could be a mystery. It could be an exploration. It could be a fight scene. It could be a murder. It could be an investigation scene. Like, it could be anything. It could be all
role. It could be like a holodeck nonsense. You know, everyone shows up in your famous, French accent.
It could be a holodeck nonsense, or it could be it could suddenly be revealed to be a training mission at the end, and they're all still back at Starfleet Academy in the holosuite. So yeah, for sure.
And to your point, like, there was a game mechanic in Star Trek Adventures where if you don't bring a phaser with you, you reduce the threat die.
That's right.
You bring into the mission, sort of dictates how much the GM can fuck you.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me again of Star Wars, right? Of Yoda's famous lines to Luke is, Luke, your weapons, you will not need them. But he puts them on anyway, and Yoda just shakes his head and sighs. I told you, like, what's in there? Only what you take with you, right? If you take your lightsaber, you're going to need your lightsaber. You're going to use it. You don't need it, but you're going to think you need it, and so you will use it.
And as a child watching those movies the first time, my brain couldn't comprehend what was going on.
Yeah.
Like, okay, obviously he needed the lightsaber. There was a Darth Vader droid in there. Like, duh, Yoda. But, now as an adult who has critical thinking and has read a story or two, I'm like, oh, no, it's obvious because you brought violence with you. Violence was your answer.
We have totally slid over from Star Trek to Star Wars now, but this conversation just reminds me of that brilliant moment at the end of Return of the Jedi when the script and the movie and Mark Hamill refuse to give the audience what they think they want. Like, I want to see him turn on his lightsaber and fight the Emperor. Like, well, we're not going to give you that. Nope. He's going to throw his lightsaber away and say, that's what makes me a Jedi. And I'm like, that's so gutsy. And of course, now we've all got Boba Fett where it's all just being completely rewound. And now he's just like, badass Super Luke and whatever.
Yeah, franchise maintenance. But to bring it back to Star Trek, this is called Spaceballs. It's not called
You're right.
So I think Star Wars being set in space makes it within our purview.
Okay, very good.
To bring it back to Star Trek.
Yeah.
In this episode in particular, I don't think anything like this was an odd episode to begin. I don't think that this episode didn't feel like a premiere. So it doesn't feel like they had planned to go on hiatus in the middle of the season and premiere with this episode. There was nothing of weight or gravitas. Now, the ending of the last episode with Book stealing the MacGuffin and jumping out of a spool drive.
Yep.
That felt like a cliffhanger. And I think this episode I kept waiting for it to start, which is a weird thing to say.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Like, we had the discussion with Admiral Vance, and I thought it was really interesting to have a scene with Vance at that moment in time, because season one Bonham would have just done this.
Yes.
But season four Bonham needs the coaxing to do this, which I thought was an interesting way to position that.
Well, it's because she's captain now. That is a huge difference. Like the from a narrative weight, yeah, you're right. Like as soon as the president said, like, okay, you can't go after Book. And I thought to myself, okay, well, since when has Burnham ever done what she was told? Right. But that was first officer or POW or, you know, Burnham, who was a mutineer. And now she's captain. And the dynamic of the show I like so much better now that she's captain, because she can't just break the rules whenever she wants to. And she's not the underdog anymore. Everybody else is the underdog. And Owo is the underdog. If this episode had happened in any previous season, it would have been Burnham in the cage match fighting the guy. Right. But if Burnham fights him, it's punching down. But if Owo does it, it's punching up. You see?
It's a really small reading of that episode, of this episode in particular, in terms of like power dynamics, because I was there was one other thing I want to bring up.
Okay.
Tonka mentions the book when they're on the ship and they're flying around and yes. they're like, okay, if you save everyone's life, they're going to pull on you. Like, that's just how this works. And he's right. like, that's not how the Federation works. And I'm like, bullshit, that's not. Like, Captain Quark, like, your captain's sort of like spiritual mentor, Captain Quark, like, that's how he operated. Like, how, as long as I fixed everything at the end of the day, it's cool what I have to break.
How many crazy Starfleet captains or admirals have there been who would have been completely exonerated if they had simply turned themselves in and asked to be forgiven?
Yeah.
And that's part of where I think Burnham is going to come from. She's going to forgive Book. I think she can forgive him because that's what Starfleet does. But we'll see. We don't know how it's going to play out.
And also that lesson of forgiveness has been set up earlier in the season with the Quark Mallot killing that Starfleet officer.
Yep.
Like, so they've already positioned and they've already brought up this idea of just because someone wrongs you doesn't mean they need to be punished.
Yeah.
I guess it's going to matter in terms of scale and degree. One last point before we wrap this whole episode up.
Sure.
I think we can rule out the Kelvins as the 10th seat.
I think you're right. Now, if we can dive into that a little bit. So my understanding is okay, so they're beyond the galactic barrier. They never mention the word Andromeda, I don't think.
No.
Okay, they don't say they're in the Andromeda galaxy. They just say they're beyond the galactic barrier. And apparently there's another species that we do know about who lives close enough to them that their astronomical data tells us about 10C. Is that species from canon?
Oh, that species is a new thing.
Okay.
So it's right. more in brave new territory.
Okay. So when Zora says like, oh, like, yes, there's like the sphere data tells me that there's this other species that lives nearby. We can get the data we need from them. They're just inventing that. That's just a line of techno babble to explain what we need.
Yeah, we may meet them next episode. You know, if we're not doing the we have to stop Book at all cost episode, you know, we're probably going to meet this new race. What I think is more interesting is it sounds like it's a, like, so we have these galaxies, right? And this is, you know, real thing. And then those like in little stalls in between, like they kind of get pushed off from the galaxy. They just kind of thrown away and they just exist. And I think that's what they're setting up here.
Yeah.
But it's a little unclear that that's what they're going for, I think, in the dialogue.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. That these stars are outside of the galactic barrier, but not in another galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, so yeah, I don't think it's the Kelvins. And also, I mean, it's a big plot issue to be revealed here that the DMA is not malicious. It is, at worst, it is negligent. Like, you would think, creating this giant thing, that the people that make it would pay attention to the damage it can cause. but they're not.
Okay, so they bring up the idea. So let's counterpoint.
Okay, good.
They bring up the idea that this is specifically for energy.
Yes.
So essentially what is happening in the Star Trek universe is the colonizers are being colonized. Their resources, their land is being, their planets are being destroyed so that another race that's outside of, literally outside of our galaxy can get the oil resource, the plutonium, to continue fueling their magic space window thing.
I see where you're going here. It is a reversal of the what we think of as the typical sort of Federation.
And this is like, I think New Trek is really concerned about the colonizing influences of Star Trek. Like it comes from you know, Final Frontier. It comes from all this you know, it comes from Candy administration sort of mentality. And Picard was a giant season-long interrogation of, you don't just get to show up at a place, do a thing, and leave. Those people still live there. Those people still have lives. And you've just impacted their life in a significant way, and you're not following up. Like, we have a whole show that's a comedy show that's about following it up.
So the second.
So I really think New Trek is interested in not just giving lip service, like, oh, here's a whole bunch of woke people here on the Discovery. No, we're gonna like interrogate and reinterpret this idea of what the Final Frontier, what going to strange new worlds means.
Okay.
And I think Discovery is now flipping the script by having the Federation, or what remains of the Federation, be in a position of, we are being taken advantage of. When have we done this same thing?
Well, and it's eventually we're going to have some kind of first contact with Species 10C. We're going to see. I still keep thinking, though, that they might turn out to be somebody we've seen before, but probably not.
I hope not. I don't want. Okay, so this is a thing I have. You know, I keep saying one last thing. This is a thing I have with like giant franchises. And like DC Comics does this. Like DC Comics will do like a giant crossover and everyone gets to show up and everyone gets to play. But at the end, when you close the last issue, the universe is small. It's cleaner. It's a little less wondrous than it was going into it. And with the exception of like New 52. Like New 52 was like, those 52 universes here.
Yeah.
And they're all crazy.
Yeah.
And that was designed to buck the system that Crisis on Infinite Earths set up. So when we are in these media landscapes, and Star Wars is kind of the epitome of what this is they just wind up getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And a sense of wonder gets a little bit more diminished as we keep playing the nostalgic hits.
Until we're just on Tatooine every episode.
Yeah. And there was nothing wrong with being on Tatooine every episode. If you have something to say about Tatooine. That's the thing that you have to do, is you have to like actually have a story to be like, all right, what are we going to talk about?
So what I was thinking is that we're going to eventually have to have this conversation with 10C, and how is that first contact going to play out? And I have to think that from a dramatic narrative standpoint, it can't go smoothly. In other words, we can't simply resolve the situation as simply as, oh, hi, Species 10C. We're the Federation. We live on the other side of the galactic barrier. Your big, gigantic gizmo is fucking destroying our planets. Will you please stop? And they're like, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yes. That can't happen, right? Like, there has to be a conflict there. But it probably will not be resolved in a traditional violent sense, because Species 10C is vastly more advanced and powerful than the Federation, especially in its current state. So it feels like something that's going to have to get resolved through personalities, or maybe some kind of pull a technobabble solution. Let's put a bomb in the middle of the Klingon moon resolution.
Take my goat. Okay. I think what you're saying is the resolution of this needs to be less Klingon bomb and more bringing it back to Babylon 5.
Sure.
More Sheridan gives a dressing down to the Volans and the Shadows, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, it needs to be something, like, you can still have your explosions because it's still, like, a TV show designed for Western audiences predominantly.
Yeah.
And big explosions signals that you're in the finale. That can still be happening, but it needs to come down to a conversation between Bonham and whoever Ten C or whatever Ten C actually is.
Yeah.
To get the resolution. The interesting part of this is that whenever we see a false contact situation, it's us going down to them.
Yes, right. It's
we as the Federation and as the Federation being a stand-in for America, go down and visit the newly they've met all threshold for we can talk to you.
Yes.
We won't destroy your planet because those aliens. They've met that threshold and we're like, okay, let's have a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's never been, oh no, we've been ruined. And the closest it got to that was Star Trek Insurrection, which is they introduce those Eugene Chaffall folks.
Yeah.
And they make him a protectorate like within a year of meeting the Federation.
Yep.
And Picard makes the line of, because we're being so badly beaten by the Borg and the Dominion, you know, we've expedited the process. That's as close as we've ever gotten. We've now lost planets to this thing.
Right, right, right.
And this thing can have the potential of doing a lot worse if this is just their mining operation.
I think it's going to have to be, I don't think that a dramatic conversation will be enough to put a suitable bow on all of the tension of this season. I think it's going to have to be some kind of big special effects extravaganza. Like we're going to fly book ship loaded with, you know, explosives into the middle of the DMA and blow it up, or something ridiculous like that.
Oh, and this is me going on a limb because they said this season is inspired by COVID.
Yep.
Maybe it's an anticlimax.
Yep.
Maybe it is like once Bonham does talk and get through to the people and be like, hey, this is what's happening on all end. Maybe we can find other ways to get your your gizmo. Maybe those are some other unobtainium, you know, those some other solution that we can come up to. And they're like, okay.
Tark has got to be involved here, right? Like,
oh yeah, he's too big, and he's too good of an actor. Like, I don't like the guy, but it's the same. Like going back to wrestling, like when a heel's really good, like I want to fight the guy, but I also love the fact that he's on my screen because I want to fight the guy, and he's doing the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tark kind of has that, except he's got the moral superior, like not moral. He's got the intellectual superiority.
Yeah, right, right.
Like he doesn't have like Khan's charisma. Like he's not necessarily like a Khan, and he's not slimy like the Khan. But he's got this weird like hibernation of those two sort of great Trek villains.
He's a good antagonist. I like him as a antagonist. You know, he's the sudden but inevitable betrayal is coming. Right.
And I hope they don't blow him up at the end of the season. Like, because that feels like a waste. Like, oh, yeah, we just created a cool guy.
Yeah.
We just blew him up.
Hopefully keep him around. All right. Well, listen, we have taken a pretty good turn on this episode. Next week will be our next. We will be back. But Discovery is not in the habit of giving us any trailers or anything these days. So we don't really know anything about the next episode. We don't even know its name. But we will be back and see you then, maybe with a guest. Maybe if we're lucky, we can get a guest. And we'll see you then on Space Force.